Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Toxic Psychiatry, Talking Back to Prozac, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now the book that shows you how to achieve emotional freedom from your painful feelings, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. It's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, with international cutting-edge guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology, and how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. It is Peter Bregan, and I'm so glad to be here with my wonderful audience and a very unusual and special guest. But first, did you hear the new introduction? It's mentioning Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, the book. They do a good job at PRN. I just said, hey, I want to get my book in now to my intro, and bingo, it was done beautifully. It's a real professional group of people to work with. Well, I've got great news, and then a little glitch in the great news. The great news. The book, after the book's been out for less than a month, it's now about a month, but by 3 weeks, it was into its third printing. That's really unusual in my area of the universe, and really, really good news. So thank you for those of you who have ordered the book, and it's just much appreciated. It's gotten just really good reviews. I think I may have mentioned it's even gotten a good review in Publishers Weekly, calling it a really good self-help book. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's what it fundamentally is. It's a self-help book with some really new understandings about biological evolution and childhood and the relationship between the two. The glitch is that we don't have any books anymore. We have had such an overwhelming response to our special offer of the book and the antidepressant fact book along with it. The response has been so good that we've sold out, and the printing won't be available. The second and third printing is not going to get to us until about January 16th. So we have 150 orders on backlog. We were able to fill the first 100 or so, and we're still getting orders, and we're really happy to get them. We are going to fulfill them within 48 hours, I promise you, of our receipt of the books. And my wife is standing beside me. She doesn't usually deign to do that when I start my show. But I called her in because I was having a glitch, and she's my glitch person in regard to technology and anything requiring higher intelligence. I'm the vocals. But anyway, Ginger is nodding that she's so glad I told you that we will fulfill within 48 hours of receipt. So just keep on ordering, please. We have plenty of the antidepressant fact book left right now. We're going to be able to continue to fulfill the order by giving you two books, almost for the price of one, which is really, really cool. Okay, my guest, Brant, are you here?
Yes, Peter.
Oh, you sound really, really good, too. My guest today, I really think, is a really interesting and wonderful and a person whom, again, I basically met through my wife, who met him through a blog or column he'd written critical of Ezekiel Emanuel's statement that after 75, people aren't productive. It sort of got me a little bit. It's being 78. And we should think about rearranging medical care. And I'm gonna leave it up to Brant to get into that with you. And what we're going to talk about today is something that is almost never talked about, and I haven't talked about it nearly enough on the air. We're going to focus on the issues of, you know, who should be saved and who shouldn't, and is life worth living, even if somebody else doesn't think so? Who should set the standards for whether you should get care and be allowed to live? Some of the worst consequences in the form of the Nazi regime getting its inspiration from psychiatric euthanasia. We'll talk about that. Literally, the three of the top experts at the Nuremberg trials, four of them actually, said that the Holocaust probably wouldn't have occurred without psychiatry proving they could get away with their own little Holocaust of murdering mental patients by the hundreds of thousands. His name is Brandt. Oh, and I've asked Brandt already. I'm going to tell you in advance. I've asked him to come back on February 6th because then I want to talk about a somewhat separate but connected subject, which is managed care in general, and his, I think, extremely intelligent critique as both a doctor, a medical doc, and a lawyer. So his name is Brandt Mittler, B-R-A-N-T-M-I-T-T-L-E-R. He's an M.D. He's a J.D. He's in San Antonio, Texas, where he's been for quite a long time. And right now his most active practice is in healthcare law. And he actually does litigation. It's really interesting. He's a cardiologist full-time for 22 years. And like me, did his undergraduate work at Harvard, but 10 years behind me, which makes him very young. Not so young. Makes him an old man in the eyes of Ezekiel Emanuel and on his way to the end. He had cardiology training at some of the best places, including Duke, and got his law degree at St. Mary's. He's written on healthcare policy and lectured on it all over the place, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, New York Times. He's done something which I would love to do, but only did once, and that's another story for another time, which is consulted to the networks on healthcare issues and how they present them on the air. And he's appeared himself, which we do share on things like ABC News, World News Tonight, and NBC's Nightly News, CNN, Good Morning America, and so on, discussing, in his case, healthcare policy. He's been a medical expert in state and federal courts, but what I envy is he goes in as a lawyer, because I'll tell you, there's nothing more helpless feeling than being an expert at the mercy of your lawyer's competence, your judge's reasonableness, and the ethics of the other side, which are usually small indeed. Well, with that robust introduction, I've just enjoyed so much talking with you, Brandt, in preparation for the show. I mean, it's just been a delight to begin to get to know you. So, hi.
Hi, Peter. Thank you very much for those very generous words and for having me on your show. I've enjoyed talking to you, too. And also reading your really important work you've done in so many areas of psychiatry and medicine.
Thank you. Brandt's been interested in the Holocaust and the role of psychiatry, and then was getting a more conventional view of it until you came across my article, which Ginger sent to you.
Yes, your wife sent me the article. It's called Psychiatry's Role in the Holocaust, and it was published in 1993 in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. And it's such an important article because you give the background of psychiatry's role in the Holocaust and also point out that psychiatrists initiated the euthanasia or killing of unfit or mentally defective patients before the Nazis and actually continued it after the Nazis. And I think you also have a very important critique of a prominent psychiatrist, Robert J. Lifton from Yale, who has written two really important books, one, The Genocidal Mentality, and and the other Nazi doctors, but you have a really important critique of Lifton, of Dr. Lifton, in pointing out that he really blamed a lot, most of what went on the Nazis, and didn't focus his criticism, as you did, on the profession. So
yeah,
I think that was that's
one of
an
the
enormous
things that
contribution.
Lifton did, which I thought was so characteristic of American psychiatrists, is he said the Nazi experiments were generally bad in the concentration camps, but that he thought they did worthwhile experiments on electroshock treatment. Congratulations, Dr. Lifton from Yale. That's the status of, oh, God bless my colleagues of American psychiatry. It's so wonderful that you've been doing your work and I've been doing mine, and we're finding this intersection. I don't know if we should get too much into the Nazi Germany issues right now and the fact that psychiatry was there beforehand as they were. Or let's talk more just about your own work. And maybe that stunning commentary that you wrote on Ezekiel Emanuel and where that came from and what your thinking is on life and death issues like that in healthcare.
Well, I came to that commentary really kind of a circuitous route. I started off at Duke as a medical student, and as a medical student was introduced to something called the cardiovascular data bank. There were a few really forward-thinking people at Duke, one of whom being the legendary internal medicine professor, Dr. Eugene Stead, who passed away a few years ago, but who is credited with training more professors of internal medicine than probably anyone else in the world. But Dr. Stead introduced this concept to a few people, and mainly cardiologists, that it was important to look at actual outcomes of patients. Now, this was very similar to what the Boston physician E.A. Codman had tried to do at Harvard Medical School at the turn of the century. Codman is credited with being the father of the quality assurance movement. And anyway, Codman didn't fare well with the Harvard faculty, who really didn't want to see how their actual outcomes came out. And he was pretty much, you know, run out of the faculty and had to start his own little hospital and published his findings really as the introduction to a book called The Shoulder, which is still a classic in orthopedic surgery. Well, in that background, fast forward to the 1970s when I was at Duke, and Dr. Stead had the idea that, you know, really the best way to tell a patient sitting in front of you of how he's going to do his or her prognosis is by looking at how the institution has treated other patients like that patient. And that's why at the time we developed this computer data bank. There was an IBM computer that filled a huge room. That computer was, you know, now that the entire data bank can be put practically on a small tablet or a small laptop, but then it took a whole room of computing power. And Duke, we actually computerized the medical record. In other words, when people did histories and physicals and discharge summaries, this was almost 45 years ago, the electronic medical record produced reports of heart procedures and catheterizations and the early echocardiograms and all of that. But doctors, then they could see what happened to their patients, and outcomes were tracked every 6 months over time. There was a separate group of people who called the patient and said, are you alive? How are you feeling? What's happened to you? And so all of this information was the doctors at Duke at the time could present to their patients. Now, I know this seems rather long-winded. How do we get from there to issues of eugenics and people dying at age 75? Well, here's how you get there. At the same time, there was a movement developing, really fostered by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I was in a program of theirs called the Clinical Scholars Program, which just ended a couple of years, actually this past year. But they were training doctors in health policy and in clinical medicine. And there was a big philosophical debate. What's the best way to figure out outcomes? Should you look at just the actual outcomes of actual patients, or should you get a hand-picked group of experts together, professors and other experts, who would figure out what the appropriate care was? And I think by now most people in medicine know, and probably the lay people listening don't know, the politics of the situation was such that the experts carried the day. So what happened was is that almost our entire medical science of appropriateness of care and guidelines was directed towards this process of getting a few hand-picked experts together, a highly politicized process, and those experts decided the right way to practice medicine. You go from there, so you have a small group of experts deciding the right way to practice medicine, and that really brings up issues of really kind of parallels to the eugenics movement, which started in the early 1900s, really in the United States, where you had a small group of experts deciding who was fit to reproduce, what was the right kind of population, who were the right kind of people to have in your population, you know, who was unfit. And so I think the thinking kind of falls into this category of the tyranny of experts. And what have experts wrought in the practice of medicine and to our to the whole science of deciding the best way to treat patients, who lives, who dies, who is a fit versus unfit member of society?
Well, you know, in psychiatry, the outcomes are so bad that we never look at outcomes, because every time we do, occasionally somebody. And I had a marvelous psychologist on the air here just a few weeks ago, does do outcome studies, and the drugs don't work and they make people worse. So psychiatry is totally dependent on drug company funded experts for their opinions. They set all the standards. Literally, the drug company funded experts set all the standards in our field. But it sounds like in many ways it's similar in every field. I think it's maybe a little more gross in my field. When you were telling me the story, you talked about how you came upon the fact that they were still sterilizing patients in the southeast region.
A basic part process in the eugenics movement was forced sterilization, and I was just reviewing some numbers before the show, and I think the numbers that sticks out is about 60,000, at least there were documented 60,000 forced sterilizations in the United States between the early 1900s and maybe 1960. About 20,000 of those occurred in California, but about 8,000 of them occurred in North Carolina. And I went to medical school at Duke in North Carolina. Did 2 years of cardiology training at Duke, and in fact, I still have an adjunct appointment as a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Duke University School of Medicine. Now, I'm not speaking in any way officially on behalf of Duke, but I'm just saying I do maintain ties with Duke. But here's what I never knew. In 2002, the newspaper in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, published a really groundbreaking series on eugenics in North Carolina, forced sterilization, and they published what I never realized when I was a medical student or cardiology fellow at Duke, that all the way up into the early 1970s there were forced sterilizations going on in North Carolina. And then I read further articles last year of how the North Carolina legislature passed a bill that gave reparations to some few hundred victims of forced sterilization. They gave each of these several hundred people $20,000 apiece. There were calls for $50,000, but the state said they only had the budget for $20,000. So that's basically what the victims of forced sterilization, most of whom were African-American women, poor people, people of color. These were the people who underwent forced sterilization in North Carolina. So when I read about the reparations, I decided that there had been some communication with our medical school class of 1972, and I sent an email out on our listserv and said, you know, look at all this publicity we're going to have a reunion pretty soon. Why don't we make as a class topic, let's study the eugenics movement at Duke and see if we can do some research on this. Do any of you know if any of this occurred? Well, I think three classmates sent emails and said, yes, I know of a case. And so they apparently knew of a case of cases while we were there. But then there was a great outpouring of anger and resentment towards me for even bringing the topic up and say it'll just bring bad publicity to Duke and bring back bad memories, you know. And you certainly know about that from your writings about these kinds of issues. So I even contacted some of the some professors at Duke in non-medical departments who were associated with some writing about this issue, but none of them wanted to go forward with any kind of a seminar. I offered to provide some money for a seminar, much as they had it at Bowman Gray in Winston-Salem. That medical school at least had a one-day seminar contemplating the eugenics movement in North Carolina and Bowman Gray's role in that. But there was no interest at Duke, which really didn't surprise me.
Let me give you a little other surprise. I don't know if you're aware of it about Duke. I was a medical expert against Duke and Bernie Bressler, a psychiatrist there, who was producing so much money for Duke that they gave him his own ward in a hotel. And Bernie would sleep with his patients. He would have sex with his patients. He'd go into business with his patients. And when two of them complained, he sent them for lobotomies to Boston at the hands of one of the real old-time brain choppers in Boston. And the statute of limitations had long passed, and the whole case rested on – the two cases rested on my appealing – writing a statement to the judge describing how lobotomy works and shock treatment and all the other things that were done to these women and how that would have prevented them in any way whatsoever – from ever having the ability to bring a lawsuit so that the statute shouldn't run. And I don't know that there was any provision in the law for what I was saying. And the judge in one of the cases said he was going to go completely along with what I was saying, and the statute wasn't going to run. And they settled for the max of the insurance policies. At least Bernie's did. I don't know what happened with Duke. And then in the second case, the judge said, well, this Bregan's argument is very strong. We'll leave it up to the jury, to a jury trial. And they just settled rather than go to a jury trial. And that was another undercover thing at Duke. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Well, I sure did. And I'm not here to badmouth Duke, but this is reality. When I was a second-year medical student, that was introduced to clinical medicine, and we had I think 6 or 7 week rotations, and the psychiatry rotation I was put on Dr. Bressler's service.
Oh no.
And after about 10 days to 2 weeks, I demanded to be taken off that service. I said, there's no teaching going on. This is just mayhem. I was observing, I mean, I can't remember the specifics, but I remember there was just total mayhem. I couldn't take it. And that was one of a few run-ins I had with on various with various courses. One was in anatomy.
How do we have so much in common?
Isn't that amazing?
Having followed some of those
Bressler stories, I know that the university tried to cover that up. So when you mentioned cover up, you're absolutely right. That was a real shocking episode.
The real shocking, you know, the part about the lobotomies did not occur under Dr. Brody's chairmanship. He came in right afterward. But I think some of the cover-up, and Brody was chairman of the department, and then he was dean or president of the school or something, and he was a psychiatrist, and he certainly wasn't going to deal directly with these issues. But they didn't occur under his watch on the wards.
Well, let me – you know, there's a relationship to, say, the Bressler story, and we had a problem with the chairman of anatomy, who, by the way, ended up going to federal prison after later, when he wasn't chairman, after he tried to poison a judge.
Oh, God.
That was another wild scandal that had occurred. But the point is that going back to the cardiovascular data bank, one of the things that we found was that, and I'm not going to name names, but some of the most politically powerful professors of surgery had some of the worst outcomes. And since we were tracking almost 500 prognostic variables, we could do in-depth analysis and show it wasn't because they were operating on the sickest patients. Now, that immediately, as both a fellow and a medical student, showed me that one had to question authority. Because the medical school model, as you know, is that the professor is all-knowing and omniscient, right? And everything the professor does is correct. Well, here, if you look at actual outcomes, you start to question that authority. And it puts knowledge in the hands of average practitioners, even medical students, who can start making better decisions and maybe even some of the professors about whether someone should have bypass surgery versus medical surgery. And now it's bypass surgery, versus medical therapy. So now it's bypass, medicine, stents, and everything else. So it does, you know, it does raise this whole issue of medical authority and how, and should people trust the words of experts.
That is so incredibly important. One of the things, you know, I'm still so naive. I still hope for the best. I just get so disappointed when I find out the general medicine and surgery may not be any more trustworthy than psychiatry, the field I know, or that the auto industry and other industries may not be any more trustworthy, or maybe they can't be any less than the psychopharmaceutical industry. Right. Life is like that, and we might, maybe some point we could, on a show, one of our meetings together, maybe in February 6th, just talk about evil. Because, you know, Duke is one of the most respected medical schools in the country. I really want that known to people. They may not know that. We're not lambasting an inferior program. Psychiatric program is extremely biological and extremely ECT-oriented, which is typical of all of the top programs. They're always the worst in psychiatry. In medicine, I would expect more. But there is this question of human beings, of evil, of what do we do to build a society which at least sets as much limit on human evil as we can. And that might be an interesting and broad discussion, maybe on February 6th.
I think I'll need to prepare, and let's talk about it then. I agree. And I want to follow up on what you said. I'm not here to lambast my alma mater. In fact, if I, you know, compared the education I received at Harvard as an undergraduate, the education I received as an undergraduate medical student at Duke, I will say that really I was introduced to this tremendous concept of critical analysis at Duke. And I think some of the most perceptive, forthright thinkers that I've met anywhere. And unfortunately, they did not succeed politically. The people who were part of this data bank process, they didn't succeed within the university. Those of us who were cardiology fellows, all of us have gone to private practice. We were kind of banned from academic medicine. But I think, you know, to go along with the theme of your show of inspiration, what people should be inspired about is we really do have the technology now to that we can follow outcomes and real outcomes in medicine. The evil that you mentioned, the evil comes in when people try to distort those realities, particularly, as you mentioned, in an area of psychiatry or in an area of cardiology, which I'm more familiar with. And we have to push for is using the really powerful tools we have combined with a political process that tries to strive for truth in a way that doctors and patients can work together to look at real outcomes and look at real choices and look at the risks and benefits of the various approaches to deal with what we call disease.
Folks, you are honored to be listening to Dr. Brant Mittler, M-I-T-T-L-E-R, M-D, J-D. He's now pretty much, I guess, really focusing on the law and has a legal practice in San Antonio. We'll go to break. And, Doc, it's turning out to be a better show than I even hoped for. Thank you. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks.
Keep listening to PRN. Listening to PRN. Listening to PRN. The Progressive Radio Network.
Hi. Hi, Brant.
Hello.
Brant?
Yes. Hi, Peter.
Hi. You having a good time?
Great.
You're not going to get in too much trouble?
I can't believe that we have that common knowledge about Bressler, but I want to hear all everything you...
Oh, that was just amazing and bizarre. I wrote about it in one of my books. Deserves a book unto itself.
I've got to read that. You'll have to send me that reference.
When these women would complain finally and say, you know, you're having sex with me, you've taken my money, he'd give them shock, and if that didn't shut him up, he'd send them for lobotomies.
He'd have me doing, as a second-year medical student, this is my primary psychiatry rotation, he'd have me go talk to these people about what they wanted, call for their hairdresser, call for a hair appointment, or go get this for them, or you're like running errands. This is not psychiatry. And
he had a boutique ward of his own.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
That whole psychiatry department when he was there was incredible.
A guy named Busey.
Yeah. And then what was the other fellow's name? Anyway.
Brody came in.
Yeah. But anyway, it was a mess. And I knew a lot about it because of my late father-in-law who had been the chairman of zoology there and who unfortunately committed suicide, but he was under the care of some of those people. And my late mother-in-law ex-mother-in-law was very upset about what was going on in psychiatry there. So,
wow.
Brilliant man, but my ex-father-in-law. Any case, but you bring up so many important issues.
Yeah, well, I think it might be good to come back and talk about Ezekiel Emanuel and that issue and get back rooted in some of these issues that about longevity and stuff, okay, and about euthanasia. And we'll be going on in any time now, maybe next minute or two.
Okay.
I think it's going really, really well.
Well, thank you.
And you have a great radio voice.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks very much.
Oh, you really do. You ought to do some radio or TV.
Well, I did some for a while, but a little bit of TV. But people, you know, they generally don't like I did some ABC home shows, and they said, you know, you're a little too controversial. So I like to deal with controversy.
That's why I have my little tiny radio show. But I didn't tell you, I get to talk to 6 million people every week or two.
Wow.
I'm the psychiatrist in residence on the largest evening talk show in America, which is Coast to Coast. It goes on at 10 o'clock on the West Coast and I guess 12 where you are and 1 a.m. for me.
Okay. What is that?
It's on the major conservative stations, the one that wherever it is carrying that carries Hannity and Rush and everybody.
Oh, great.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan talking over the music by Vangelis. Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for being here. And thanks for racking up nice numbers on the downloads on the PRN website, where you can get usually the same evening, you can get the I'm going to say the PDF. But what is that called? It's not a PDF. It's the pod or whatever of the show. You can also get it on Podbean. Carries all the shows all the way back to the beginning. We're talking with Brant Mittler, MD, JD, from San Antonio. And it's true now you'd mostly do legal work as an attorney rather than a medical expert even, right?
That's true, Peter. And I went to law school in 1998 and was graduated in 2001 and started the practice of law then. And mainly I'm involved in healthcare litigation, medical malpractice cases, medical product liability cases. Some of the cases I've done have involved psychoactive drugs, the ill effects of drugs. I also represent doctors in hospital credentialing and peer review matters, which does bring up issues of psychiatry, which we might discuss at some point.
What made you decide to become a lawyer? I've had fantasies of that, especially when they were attacking my medical license back in the 80s. I had fantasies. You do this to me, I'll get a law degree.
Yeah. Well, you're right. As you know, for the people who aren't doctors, we could tell them that when you go into a doctor's lounge in a hospital, 90% of the conversation is doctors vowing to go to law school and get even with some attorney who's doing something bad to them. But
well, what made you decide?
Well, you know, first of all, when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I was a member of the debate team, and so I hung out with a lot of lawyers. In fact, Larry Tribe, the great Harvard professor, was our coach then. And I couldn't decide really whether to go to law school or medical school. I worked my way through college at the Mass General Hospital in the Department of Dermatology, and the chairman of dermatology at Harvard, the late Dr. Tom Fitzpatrick, took me under his wing, and he said, "Why don't you go to medical school first?" He says, and he told me, "You can always become a lawyer, but become a doctor first." So I did, and I had that desire to be a lawyer. I was heavily involved in issues of health policy and managed care throughout my medical career, and finally, when I got to be about 50 years old, I decided that it was, you know, probably time to change to law and see if I could help what I term patients and now clients through the law, which I did.
Let's talk about Ezekiel Emanuel. Tell us who he is and who his famous brother is and how you got interested in writing a blog about his viewpoints.
Well, Zeke Emanuel's a famous American doctor. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a former director of the National Institutes of Health Department of Clinical Bioethics. He's an oncologist, I believe, by training. He has a PhD, I think, in political science. He's a frequent contributor to New York Times and MSNBC's Morning Joe. He was one of the architects of what's called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. He's been an advisor to more than one U.S. president. He's a famous man in American medicine, and he's one of three brothers. His brother, Rahm, is I think most people know, currently mayor of Chicago and formerly White House chief of staff. His brother Ari is a famous Hollywood agent. I think he's Joe Scarborough's agent, one of the hosts of Morning Joe. The New York Times says he got Joe Scarborough a contract for $99,000 a week on that show, so that's pretty good work. And I think he was the subject of the TV series Entourage, or the star of the show was based on him, the lead actor. So it's a very, very famous family in the United States. There are three powerful brothers, and Zeke is very powerful in medicine. So when he wrote this article in The Atlantic in the September 17th, 2014 edition, "Why I Hope to Die at 75, and with the subtitle, "An Argument to Society and Families and You Will Be Better Off If Nature Takes Its Course Swiftly and Promptly," I took notice. I had read Zeke's most recent book, or a relatively recent book on health policy, and my perception is that when Zeke Emanuel speaks, it can have important implications for health policy. And so I think all of us need to take this essay seriously, even though Dr. Emanuel says, well, these were just private musings. Well, if they were so private, why did he paste them all over several multicolor pages of The Atlantic and then appear on a whole lot of talk shows explaining why these were just his private thoughts?
Well, please go on and tell us his thoughts.
Well, his thoughts are as he lays out in this essay, are that people become less productive as they get older, particularly after age 60. What particularly, and he said, I'm going to go back to his science, quote, scientific argument, but he just said, when I personally reach 75, I don't want flu shots, I don't want any more preventive care, I don't want a PSA to check my prostate. If I get pneumonia, I don't want antibiotics. I just want to be allowed to die if that's the course. I don't want anything extraordinary. He said, I don't want a pacemaker. I mean, relatively simple things. You know, we put pacemakers in people at 75 or 80 all the time. They have a heart rate of 30. 1 minute, they're not doing too well. The next minute, they have a heart rate of 72. They're feeling great. They go back to doing what they were doing before, enjoying their kids, grandkids, enjoying their work. But according to Zeke, he's willing to forego all that. Now, I thought what was particularly ominous was this graphic that's published in the article, where on one axis, it says productivity, and on the that's on the vertical axis, and on the horizontal axis of the graph, there's age. And it shows that the best contributions of a person, and this is labeled productivity of people with high creative potential. The best contribution comes at age 40, and the last contribution comes at age 60, and there's a big drop-off after that. And so what he argues in his essay is that, you know, as we get older, we're not as productive for society. And therefore, you know, we ought to think about he's going to think about dying. And I think the implication is that we all ought to also. And the further implication is that when we set health policy, that perhaps we shouldn't, as a society, pay for those who aren't productive. Because here's what the economists that have been running healthcare policy have said for so long.
Brent, let me interrupt for a minute, because that is so incredibly important, what you said. He's saying, folks, and this is so important, that this isn't just about old people, because it's about productive people. So now we begin to set a standard for whether people are productive or not, and therefore whether they should get medical care, whether they should eventually be allowed to live. The tying this into the first part of the show, the first book that ever came out calling for the extermination of useless eaters was in 1920, before Hitler was in power. Hitler was just still trying to, you know, take over create a party back in 1920 and get some momentum. And one of them was a lawyer who wrote the book, a fellow named Binding, and the other was a psychiatrist named Hoche, H-O-C-H-E. And they called for the extermination of useless eaters. This is before Hitler. Hitler learned from psychiatry and the law how to go about thinking about people. And I'm just so glad you got right to the productivity issue, because it's not about age. It's about somebody deciding whether you're worth living, whether you're a useless eater or not.
Those are such important observations. Thank you, Peter. Thanks for focusing my comments and bringing those really that important perspective to this whole analysis.
Well, if I haven't taken away too much of the wind out of your sails, get back to sailing again and talk about some more about the implications of this. You have so much more expertise. I'm not even in the same room with you on your expertise on the implications of this for organized medicine.
You're too kind. But I wanted to link this whole issue of productivity to another phrase, which your listeners need to look up. Look up the term global competitiveness, because if you see a lot of the arguments by economists of both political parties over the years, especially recent years, that are arguing about containing healthcare costs. They say we have to contain U.S. healthcare costs so so that the United States will be globally competitive. To me, this is linked to this whole issue of productivity. In other words, we need productive people who can enhance the U.S.'s global competitiveness. Now, I don't know what that means, but to me, and I don't want to sound too paranoid, but to me, this brings up issues of eugenic type issues that we need. We as a society have to improve the population, so to speak. We have to weed out the unfit. We have to make sure that we have a productive population so we can be globally competitive. And I think as physicians who are concerned about individual patients, that we need to be mindful about what's going on. And this is the last comment before I ask you to comment more. Another important concept that people need to understand that's circulating in academic medical circles at the highest level of health policy, the level of the White House, the economic advisors, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is this whole concept of we have to move from taking care of individual patients to population health. That's a key phrase, population health. So, again, this conjures up the same kind of issues, I think, that were being debated at the turn of the 20th century in terms of the eugenics movement. And listeners need to understand that these movements were advanced by what was called science, that the major medical journals in the United States, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the New England Journal of Medicine, and Peter, as you've pointed out, the American Journal of Psychiatry, all of the best medical scientists were behind this process of weeding out the unfit. I think it has parallels for our current debates in healthcare policy.
Yeah, in the early 1940s, folks, the American Psychiatric Association, its leaders, knowing that German psychiatry was in the process of sterilizing and killing as many of their patients as they could, literally emptying whole state hospitals. Imagine a profession so ideological it would kill off its own clients. That while that was going on, instead of protesting it, the American Psychiatric Association held a debate at its annual meeting in which it, on one side of the debate was, should we sterilize the 5-year-old mentally retarded in our country, which is what they were called, mentally retarded, should we sterilize them or should we kill them? There wasn't even another alternative being debated. And after the debate, the American Psychiatric Association came out with an editorial favoring the murder of 5-year-olds who were retarded. And it said we need to use our psychiatric skills to help parents get over their misguided guilt about this kind of thing. You can find this material either in my chapter in The War Against Children of Color, where I have it's a paperback, where I have a chapter on this program, or you can go to my website and search out the murder of mental patients. Do you remember the exact title of that thing? Do you have my paper in front of you? I forget exactly what I called it, but look up murder of mental patients go to my scientific papers and look for 1993. It's chronologic, and you'll find my paper citing the exact issues of the psychiatric journal, citing the arguments that were made. We do have this potential in our country, folks. Could you say some more, Brandt, about who is saying this stuff? You've mentioned the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation supporting this. The Carnegie Foundation was a big supporter, and the Rockefeller Foundation was supporting eugenics in Germany. They were literally supporting the biggest eugenicist institute, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany, leading up to all of this.
Well, that's right. Those were the big foundations of the time, as you pointed out. Carnegie and Rockefeller were supporting eugenics. my comment about the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it's one of the, you know, the huge influences on healthcare policy in the U.S. and has been for the last 40 years, is that they, you know, they very much are now focusing on what they term population health, looking at populations, and that's where we should be focusing our attention. I'm not saying they're in favor of eugenics. I'm not accusing them of that, but I'm saying that when we get away from dealing with the individual patient in front of us, when I take care of someone as a patient, how can I make a decision, okay, I can't order this test for this patient because the money would be better used in some population in rural Idaho or in rural South Texas? I mean, ethically, I've got to take care of the patient in front of me. Now, that doesn't mean I should be doing unnecessary testing, of course, and there are debates about what's necessary or unnecessary. But for sure, it's very difficult for an individual doctor taking care of an individual patient to somehow decide what's best for the population. And what I'm fearful of is that those doctors are going to be influenced and coerced by guidelines handed down by experts and managed care medical directors that will, you know, emphasize other values besides what's best for the individual patient. So those are the kinds of things I worry about. Now, let's get back to the elderly. There's a website called eprognosis.org, little e, prognosis.org. On that website, people and lay people and health practitioners can go on there, and they can plug in variables, and according to certain algorithms, there are numbers given for the life expectancy of, say, people in nursing homes. I did that before the show today and answered a question about, does this patient have dementia, and then found and answered yes, and then found out that the prognosis that was given was based on a study of patients with, quote, advanced dementia. So practitioners could use this kind of algorithm, which hasn't even been clinically approved or tested, to make life and death decisions about people in nursing homes right now.
Wow. I'm just trying to think of questions to keep you talking about
Well, let me just talk about e-prognosis. So when this was first published in the Journal of the American Medical Association and other journals, New England Journal of Medicine alluded to it, I sent a letter of protest as a patient and a lawyer, you know, I mean, as a doctor and a lawyer to the Food and Drug Administration and said, I think this falls under your regulation, and they agreed. And they did nothing about it. They sent me, in fact, a dear correspondent letter to whom it may concern about a year ago and say, we're still investigating. So, I mean, here's an algorithm that doctors can use to decide to withhold care from somebody in a nursing home. And it hasn't even been clinically validated, to tell you the truth. And the FDA doesn't care about it. So that should be of great concern to everybody listening to this show.
And as some of my listeners already know, one of the reasons for the short-livedness of dementia patients is that they're being given antipsychotic drugs like Abilify and Zyprexa and Risperdal, which greatly increase the death rate among dementia patients. Really, any older person is going to experience a greatly enhanced death rate on the antipsychotic drugs. It's just such a web of disaster, medicine, psychiatry, today. We have about, 4 or 5 minutes left. Some summary parting thoughts, and I want to remind you that Dr. Brant Mittler is going to be back on the show on February 6th, which I hope I'm going to check my book as a Wednesday, that I do know what I'm doing. Lo and behold, it is a Wednesday, February 4th. So he'll be back then, and we're going to talk some more about managed care and health care. We're not going to focus on the life in, well, we're not going to focus on the eugenic issues the way we have today, or psychiatry in Nazi Germany and before Nazi Germany, how it helped create Nazi Germany. We're going to talk more and more about the overall healthcare issues in America. Brant, I'm dying to ask this, and it's a really difficult question to ask in terms of politics. But could you make clear that this is an across the board issue, these problems? Now, obviously, Zeke Emanuel comes from a progressive family line. He's a big left wing progressive person, has a lot of influence. Do you think that that this is in any way a politically shared across the line? Are we conservatives going to think this way? Libertarians going to think this way?
Well, I think both major political parties think this way in terms of considering really the costs of health care. You know, when I started talking about this nationally back in 1985, I was sought after for the soundbite, doctors are becoming hired hands of giant corporations, more interested in saving dollars than saving lives. And I think that this whole issue that costs are the main consideration versus the outcome for individual patients, I think this is the thinking of both political parties. It's the thinking, and so I'm not here to represent, I'm not here as you alluded to, I'm not here as an anti-liberal or anti-conservative position. I think that it's really a matter of doctors and patients versus the political classes and really the economists who advise them. Healthcare policy is created more by economists than by physicians. I mean, Zeke Emanuel has a lot of influence, but Peter Orszag and other economists like him have even more power, and so do conservative economists. So my experience is that presidents and the leaders of Congress listen to economists. They crunch numbers now, and that's what's going to determine who lives and who dies, and people should understand that.
Folks, we're going to be one of the numbers that get crunched. The individuals who will get crunched as the numbers get crunched. This raises huge issues about health care, about Obamacare, about the whole principle of state health care. For many of my listeners don't have the same cautions that I do about big government and about government serving the people. I hope that we won't lose any of you over this kind of issue. I hope that you'll stay with us and come back on February 6th to hear Brant Mittler talk again, even if you feel like, but wait, you know, we need national health care. Wait. We need planning of health care, and it has to be done on that level. Stay with us and come back. And Brant Mittler, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.